Welcome to episode 119 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and our guest for this episode is Karen Dion. The Marsh King's Daughter, Karen's recently published suspense novel, is one of those have-you-read books. So many of my fellow travelers in the crime fiction fanosphere were talking about it, it had to go to the top of my TBR list, where it belonged. Here's Karen Dion. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted that we have Karen Dion here to talk about her remarkable, just published, The Marsh King's Daughter. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy.
Let's talk about a conflicted father-daughter relationship. But seriously, let's talk about how you built a story around Helena, your protagonist, and Jacob, her father, who also happens to be a sociopath, kidnapper, and rapist.
Right. I really feel like their relationship is what's at the heart of the story. And the story came to me, it was very inspired. Basically, I woke up in the middle of the night with the first three sentences of The Marsh King's Daughter in my head, which is, if I told you my mother's name, you'd recognize it right away. My mother was famous, though she never wanted to be. Hers wasn't the kind of fame anyone would wish for. Daisy Dugard, Amanda Berry, Elizabeth Smart kind of fame, though my mother was none of them. So, obviously, the character who was speaking to me, I wasn't dreaming her, the sentences were just there. She's the daughter of a kidnapped girl and the man who took her. And so the obvious route would be to go down, you know, the road of the mother and the daughter bonding and the father being the cruel, you know, captor. But I wanted to change things up a little bit, partly because when I was growing up, I loved my father. And as I got a little older, I saw his flaws. I think that's probably common to most people. So I wanted to change things up a little bit and make a situation where my character, Helena, absolutely adores her father and does not realize that there's anything wrong with her living situation in those early years.
At the very beginning of The Marsh King's Daughter, it seemed, and you bring up the first paragraph, it just seemed like it might go in the direction, as you said, of the mother-daughter or other famous domestic suspense novels recently, like Gone Girl and Girl on a Train. But Helena is anything but unreliable. You know, it turns the girl in peril completely on its head. And I thought this was a girl in charge story. And was that part, you wanted to define a relationship between a father and a daughter. But were you also interested in creating such a strong, capable character as Helena?
I was. I really admire that quality in women, you know, the fearlessness. And I tried to cultivate that in my girls as well. We lived in Michigan's Upper Peninsula for many years. And when my two youngest were teenagers, we would go camping in a rustic campground late in the fall on the shores of Lake Superior. One year when we arrived, we had got there late, so my husband's setting up the tent using the headlights from the truck, and we had forgotten our flashlight. So I and the girls are walking down a woods road. There are bears. We're headed for a pit toilet, and no flashlight, and my girls were perfectly fine with that. That was sort of a defining moment for me. That's what I wanted, how I wanted to raise my girls, and so as a natural offshoot of that, that's the kind of character I wanted Helena to be, someone that the reader can really admire, and someone who has overcome horrible circumstances to actually make something out of herself.
That's true. Now that you mention it, I never really pity her, at least when she's telling the story of her life in Off the Grid. When I do start to pity her, and one of the things I found most poignant was what happened to her when she re-entered the quote-unquote civilized world. I thought you know, you don't have to be off the grid to have bad intentions, and once she was back in the world, she learned about things like greed.
Yes, Yeah, it was a real eye-opener for her. Her situation where she, for her first 12 years, the only adults in her life are her mother and father. And she doesn't have television. She doesn't have a grandparent or a teacher to say, hold on, wait a minute, you know, that's not how things should be. So the way she was raised in complete isolation like that, she accepted as completely normal. And she loved her life. She loved hunting and fishing and all of the things associated with the marsh. So coming out of that situation into what we would consider civilization was a real shock to her. And she actually at that point hates her father, not so much for what her father did to her mother, but for all the things that he should have taught her, she feels, that she didn't know. She doesn't know anything about technology or pop culture or social mores. She doesn't even know that a ball bounces because she's seen pictures of a ball in the National Geographic magazines they had as a cat, but she's never seen one in action. So everywhere she turns, she just feels like a fool. And, you know, I do feel really sorry for her at that point.
I also saw a strong thread of nurture versus nature. When Helena emerges from captivity, as you mentioned, she lacks these social niceties. She doesn't know that a ball bounces. She's at a loss and feeling it very acutely, you know, sort of not realizing as a 12-year-old that she'll learn all of this stuff. But when she, as she gets older and she understands what a monster her father was and is, it seems like she starts to look for those traits in herself, especially after she learns that he's escaped from prison. And I thought that was an interesting overview.
Because genetically, Helena is half a product of her mother, who is an innocent, and half a product of her father, who's a monster. So, and then more than that, she was raised to be a little carbon copy of her father. Her father cultivated those qualities in her. So, you know, at some point, she has to really dig deep and try to figure out, who is she? You know, is she, does she fit into normal society at all? Is she her father's daughter, as the title of the book, The Marsh King's Daughter? So, yeah, she has a real struggle with that, and that's why she reinvents herself. She changes her looks, she changes her name, she moves away. So the situation in the present-day part of the book is such that she is the mother of two little girls. She's still living in the Upper Peninsula. Her father has been in prison for 13 years. She feels she's responsible for putting him in prison. And then her husband doesn't know anything about this. He just, you know, sees her as a slightly outdoorsy kind of woman, I guess. So when her father escaped from prison, yeah, and, you know, Helena knows immediately that he's got a game in mind, and that's to come after her. So now she has to use the hunting and tracking skills that he taught her when she was a child to hunt him down before, you know, he can come after her and her family. So I like the way that comes around. And, you know, the father who shaped her to be a copy of himself now is threatened by that copy. I like the way that came together very much.
It did have a nice symmetry, but at least we get a window into, and I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't read it, because it's mm-hmm. really a remarkable book, and the way you get inside Helena's head is just so illuminating for people, those of us who live on the grid and, you know, can't even, you know, I joke that camping for me is going to a hotel that doesn't have room service. So and I'm certainly...
I wouldn't disagree with you now. I like my creature comforts now.
But I think, you know, I think that her journey, both metaphysical and actual in this book, is pretty remarkable, because she comes up against some significant challenges. One of them is knowing that she's the only person that can find her father before he does any more damage or hurts anybody else, but also the internal journey of realizing who she is and talking to her husband about it. And, you know, I thought that
that's right. Yeah, yeah. She realizes, you know, really too late that she could have trusted her husband with this information from the beginning. He would have understood. But, you know, she's a very, very cautious, very guarded person. She's not used to confiding. And, you know, she didn't have girlfriends growing up and so forth. So, you know, she makes some serious mistakes and has to make them right. And one is her relationship with her husband. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, at the core of this story, one of the places she has to go is back to the marsh in her mind, and she has to channel her father and his lessons in pursuit of him, and that seemed like a dark place for her to go, at least to go intentionally.
Yeah, I think so. And a couple of people who have read the book have commented on how strong Helena is. One person said he saw her as stronger than Clarice in Silence of the Lambs, which surprised me a bit. Another, and this was really sweet. David Morrell, the author who created the character Rambo and wrote First Blood, he read my book in manuscript form, and he called Helena a female Rambo, which that was a high compliment, obviously, considering the source. So, she's definitely a very strong person mentally and emotionally because her father raised her that way. So she has to dig deep to do what she has to do to protect her family.
And come out on the other side, whatever happens, she has to come out on the other side and live with the consequences of what he's done and what she does in return. Now I want to talk a little bit about fairy tales. And woven throughout the story, interspersed in the chapters, is the retelling of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale from which your book gets its title. And as dark as your story is, I feel that the unvarnished fairy tale is even darker. So I'm wondering, did the fairy tale inform your story from the very beginning? You woke up with the first paragraph in your head. At what point did you travel to Hans Christian Andersen?
Well, yeah. So I woke up with that first paragraph in my head. In the morning, it still looked good, which isn't always the case, of course, for middle-of-the-night ideas. So I wrote up several paragraphs in Helena's voice, which was basically her telling me who she is. And that's now the first page of the novel, which I think is really interesting, that it could have started just from that initial inspiration. And so at that point, I had already set the book in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the marsh. As the days went by, Helena kept talking to me. I kept writing snippets in her voice, such as her imagining what it must have been like for her mother to give birth to her, you know, alone in a cabin, a teenager, only the man who kidnapped you to help, you know, horrific, horrific circumstances. And so eventually I realized that since this character wasn't going to be quiet, I needed to find a story for her. So that's the point where I pulled my childhood fairy tale books off the shelf. Because I've always loved fairy tales, and obviously, as you can probably tell, the darker the better, yes. And I also love books like Aylin Ivey's The Snow Child that offer a modern take on it based on a fairy tale. So I started paging through, and when I found Andersen's The Marsh King's Daughter, I was just astonished at the parallel to the character that I was already working with. Because in the fairy tale, the Marsh King's Daughter is the daughter of the beautiful Egyptian princess who's been dragged under the water by the evil Marsh King. And she has that struggle with her nature in the fairy tale. By day, she's beautiful like her mother, but has her father's wicked, wild temper. And then it flips, and at night, she takes on her mother's gentle nature in the form of a hideous frog. So, you know, I could really use the structure, the events of the fairy tale, to give my story structure. So, and I knew that I wanted to actually include parts of the fairy tale in the book because the language is so beautiful and it's so lush, even if it does get a little dark in places.
Well, it's funny. When I read your book, I went back to my fairy tales and the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen, and had nightmares. So... the Disney-fied versions of themselves. They are really, they're like just like the Bible and other other places where there are parables and stories that illuminate the best and the worst of human nature. They are very, very instructive. I'm looking at the questions that your publishing company, you did a Q&A for that, and you said that you avoided reading certain books like Room before you started this, and it's interesting because, like many people, this reminded me of Room. I was not as fond of Room as I am of this. But it's interesting that you did that. I've talked to other writers who have avoided. I talked to a man who wrote a book about a lawyer who lives on the beach who said he didn't watch Goliath, which is an Amazon procedural about a lawyer that lives on the beach. So I find that a curious thing to intentionally not read something.
Well, I was working with the character before I really even was aware of the book Room. And as I would tell people roughly what the story was about, they would say, oh, that sounds like Room. So at that point, I thought, okay, I will not read Room until I'm done with my story, because I just didn't want to be influenced by it. I am once you become a professional writer and you find your own voice, you're not as easily influenced by other stories, but I just didn't want to take that chance. I wanted to tell Helena's story, you know, as purely and honestly as I could. I did a little research into, like, I read J.C. DeGard's book, and I read the book about Amanda Berry, mostly because I wanted to get a sense of what was it like for them to give birth in that situation. In The Marsh King's Daughter, I'm not telling the mother's story. I'm telling Helena's story, the daughter. But I still wanted to have a sense of what it might have been like for those women in those circumstances. So that's all the reading research that I did. The other research I did for the novel, while I lived in the Upper Peninsula for 30 years, and I know the natural world there very well, my husband and I never hunted and fished. And, you know, obviously, Helena's family living in isolation in the marsh, they depend on this for their sustenance. So I did have to research the hunting and fishing parts of the story. And I had a humorous experience happen recently because a writer who I don't know well, who was reading The Marsh King's Daughter, he wrote me a note and he said, I don't usually tell people this, but I've been an avid hunter all my life. And when I read the scenes with, you know, Helena learning to track and killing her deer and skinning the deer in the field, he said, I knew you were a hunter.
It without knowing it, it was extremely high praise.
Yes, I took that to heart. I enjoyed that a lot. The thing is, I've done a lot of research for all of my novels. Most writers do. And you can find a lot, you know, on Wikipedia, and I watched some kind of ugly YouTube videos of hunting because I needed to in order to depict those scenes accurately. But I found, because I was writing about an area that I know so well, there are so many details in the description of the seasons and the wildlife and the biology and so forth of the area. I don't think I ever would have found those no matter how much I dug around on Wikipedia. A couple of reviewers have mentioned the authenticity of the book, and you know, that makes me feel really good because I essentially, you know, lived a milder version of this many years ago.
One of the beauties of reading crime fiction is a strong story set it within a distinct sense of place, because, you know, each informs the other, and to a varying degree. In The Marsh King's Daughter, to a very great degree. I mean, it's the environment that shapes the story and shapes Helena and sort of sets the course of what happens after she becomes an adult. So that's, you know,
this is one of those stories that could only have taken place there. You know, if I'd given it a different setting, it would have been an entirely different book.
And I got the sense of the Upper Peninsula. I think most of us that live outside of Michigan, I live in Southern California. I think of Mackinac Island. You know, that's sort of my point of reference for Northern. This is most definitely not Mackinac Island.
That's true. And then I mentioned in the book, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan has 29% of the land area, but it only has 3% of the population. So it's a big, empty place. There are acres and acres and acres of state and national forests, lakes, just a lot of empty space. It's nothing to be going down the highway, you know, when you see deer, occasionally bear, coyote, bald eagles. It's a beautiful, wild place. So it was a great place to set this novel.
And also, I mean, I felt I was mildly familiar with it, other parts of it through Steve Hamilton's books. You know, and I feel now like I will be a frequent visitor to the Upper Peninsula. But it's cold. You know, it snows there. I don't go places where it snows.
Yes, it is cold. A lot.
Well, I have to ask this, and because I'm in Southern California, but also because of all the books I've read in the past year, it just seems like this book could lend itself to either the small screen or the large screen. So I'm wondering if there are any plans to bring it to television or film.
Yes, we have sold the film option, which is incredibly exciting for me, to the same people who made the movie The Revenant. So, and the screenwriter for The Revenant is going to adapt this. He's in the process of adapting the book now for feature film. So, yeah, super exciting.
Well, that just makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Although,
It does.
I hope it's not quite as icky. But it could be.
I know what you're going to say. Well, the thing is, the Marsh King's Daughter does get dark in places. I know that. It's darker than I'm even comfortable with. But the story had to go that direction. I have spoken with a screenwriter, and they assure me that they're going to be going more for a PG-13 level of violence because it's the psychological relationship that's really the heart of the story. So I was really happy to hear that they weren't going to, you know, play up the violence in the book and instead play up the relationship between Helena and her father.
Well, really, the tensest moments, I thought, went on in Helena's head.
Yeah.
You know, her, how she thought of it, how she reacted to the news of her father's escape, how she was so capable of channeling him and knowing him so well, probably because for those 12 years, it was just the three of them. She's obviously a very, very bright child and then young woman and now an adult. So she was able to see this, more than see it, she sort of knew it in every cell of her being, what he was going to do and what she needed to do as a reply.
Right. So, yeah, it was that their relationship is really very intense. And we have actually sold translation rights to the novel in 23 countries around the world, which is quite astonishing to me. And I believe it's because at heart this is a father-daughter story. So it isn't so much that people want to read about the Upper Peninsula or read this thriller. They're reading about the characters, and, you know, that makes me really happy.
Well, it is a fantastic character-driven story, and I congratulate you on it, and I'm so delighted that you had the time to speak to Speaking of Mysteries about it. And now I can't wait for the film.
Well, I have to thank you for having me. It was just my privilege to come on and talk to your listeners about my book. I really appreciate that.
And always my last question, what's next?
Oh, okay. I'm in the process of working on another novel that will share some similarities with The Marsh King's Daughter. It's not a sequel because I told Helena's complete story in the novel. I think you would probably agree. But this book will also be a psychological suspense. It's also set in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and it also has a fairy tale element, although I'm handling it in a different way than I did in The Marsh King's Daughter because I don't want to just repeat what I did the first time. A writer likes to challenge themselves. So I hope that readers, you know, will like both books for what they are, and whether they read one first and then the other, that shouldn't matter because they'll both be similar, same but different, as they say.
Well, I hope that you'll come back on the podcast to talk about that when it's released, and I thank you for your time and for joining us.
Thank you so very much.